You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, January 24th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Tony Messenger, Metro columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, author of Profit and Punishment, How America Criminalizes the Poor in the Name of Justice. Also on the program today, Russia heightens its war footing, NATO responds. A Trump-appointed judge blocks the vaccine requirement that federal, or I should say the White House requirement that federal workers be vaccinated. 98% are already in compliance. So it's just for the next time. CDC data shows unvaccinated 50-year-old and ups are 45 times more likely to be hospitalized by COVID. Meanwhile, Omicron appears to have peaked in most places around the country. Supreme Court once again to review another affirmative action policy. Seven school boards sue Virginia's Governor Youngkin over his new masking can only be optional order. Kyrsten Sinema censured by the Arizona Democratic Party over her filibuster vote. And testers at Activision Blizzard vote to unionize as employees at REI seek a vote. And all across the country, low wages and COVID driving a mass exodus of nursing home workers. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us at the beginning of the week. Here with me, as always, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Sam.
How are you?
Fine.
Great.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Big game last night,
it's
right?
It's hard for me not to talk about it. Yeah, it was such a good week.
I know, I can tell you. I can see you're just like bursting at the seams.
I'm trying to get away from it, but I can't. Yeah, it was amazing weekend. The NFL must be very happy.
Did you win?
Mm-hmm.
Yep, that's what I could tell was going on here.
I had a really rough...
I want to make it clear. We didn't say anything prior to the show beginning, but it's just clear. Like
the atmosphere.
I had a rough start because I bet on the Titans to win, which was stupid because I just thought that the offensive line would not be able to protect Joe Burrow. He ended up getting sacked 9 times, it's going to be too much. But he's the man. But then the rest of the weekend went very well for me.
Yes, yeah. I had no idea what you just said.
Even though I am sad about the Bills because I feel terribly for their fans.
Yeah, people seem very upset about it.
They're a likable team, and Josh Allen does not get the Josh Allen may be better than Mahomes right now playing in terms of this season. I got to be real. I think he's the best quarterback in the league. So
okay, well,
also I feel bad for the Bills from the 90s.
Me too. I mean, the Giants had a hand in one of those. That was the wide right field goal, 20-19.
Yeah, good old.
It was before I was born, though.
Was it Eason? Eason? Who was their quarterback that came from?
Jim Kelly, I think.
No.
Hostetler.
No, was it not Tony Eason? Was it who? Who was before Brady on the Pats that went to?
Oh, Bledsoe.
Bledsoe. Jesus, I can't believe I couldn't remember his name. All right. Well, anyways, so we got that out of the way. I knew it was like opening up a dam, but it was like you were like
close it back up.
Could see you were like shaking. You were so ecstatic. Big week ahead of us, ladies and gentlemen. We've got the whole week ahead of us, and you know it's Omicron seems to have peaked, which is good. Now we're just all waiting around for the next one. And, of course, you know there will be because it's an authoritarian state and people like to make up the idea. And so many of us on the left
radical
really
left.
Enjoy being in lockdown.
On forever.
Yeah.
We love masks. It largely hides our granola crunchy leftist ugly pimply faces.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right?
That's the big part of it. Yeah, you can eat granola in really inappropriate places and nobody can tell because
well,
you've got
gets
your mask.
Well, yep. No one can tell all your food caught in your beard.
Yep.
And that's why we have such low quality on our cameras.
There you go. Exactly. Why did someone say this? Talk about that?
People that really want us to get to 1080p.
What are these? Are these 720?
No, these cameras are good, but it's just the system we're going through.
Oh, okay. 720p. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, listen, here's the bottom line. If we upgrade the system, I'm putting, what do you call it? Stockings over the cameras. That's what you do back in the old trick back in the
stockings?
Day.
Stockings?
Yeah. Yeah, stockings softens the lens.
Oh, then, like the stuff.
Yeah, I'm old, and so I'm not gonna put 1080p, you know, 4000K or whatever the hell it is.
Someone clips Sam screaming, "I'm old."
Well, I mean, you can hear that almost like I don't
from
know,
space
10 times a day. Exactly. Let's go to this. I mean, I honestly. We spoke on Friday to Stephen Wertheim, also to Representative Ilhan Omar. Interesting conversation, I thought, with her, with both of them actually, and even with David Feldman afterwards. Although that was much more uncomfortable,
traumatizing conversation.
And but you should go and check that out. But to a certain extent, it is. There is just a momentum that's associated with NATO and our foreign policy, and not just ours, that doesn't allow for, you know, any type of sense of, like, you know, of why we need to have an alliance with a country that such an alliance provokes more potential for armed conflict. And
think about it from Russia's perspective. With the flirtation of Ukraine being in NATO, that means that I don't know how many countries are in NATO, but many countries are allied with them right along their border, and they have this
like a mutual a security agreement, and obviously you want Ukraine to have the opportunity to exist and to grow as a country, but maybe there could be a deal struck, like we will, you know, commit to allowing them to maintain some independence as long as you commit to allowing them to maintain some independence. But right now, there is a sense that Russia is, you know, primed to invade Ukraine in some fashion or another. You're starting to see talk of troop deployment, U.S. and NATO troop deployment, different places in that region. So we will see. But here is Tony Blinken on with Dana Bash on CNN. And essentially, you know, one can understand why you wouldn't take certain things off the table, because that's just the way they play this game. But nevertheless, distressing.
Scenario in which more U.S. service members become involved here?
One of the things that we've been very clear about, besides the massive economic, financial consequences that would befall Russia if it further commits aggression against Ukraine, is the ongoing, continued buildup of defense capacity in Ukraine, and equally, continuing to build up NATO's defensive capacities, including on the so-called eastern flank, the countries near Russia. And the alliance is looking at very practical and important measures that it would take in the event of further Russian aggression.
So you mentioned different kinds of aggression. Let's talk about one specific potential. Russian-backed forces currently occupy part but not all of the Donbass region in eastern Ukraine. Would seizing or recognizing the entire Donbass region qualify as an invasion and result in the crippling sanctions that you're threatening?
If a single additional Russian force goes into Ukraine in an aggressive way, as I said, that would trigger a swift, a severe, and a united response from us and from Europe. And again, there are other things that Russia could do that fall short of actually sending additional forces into Ukraine. And again, across the board, we're prepared with Europe for a swift and calibrated and very united response. We're looking at every single scenario, preparing for every single one.
President Biden said an invasion would be the most consequential thing that's happened in the world in terms of war and peace.
He's really just like leaning into that. I am a serious State Department official voice.
It's interesting, too, that he keeps saying Europe as opposed to NATO. And I wonder if that is reflects maybe some dissent within NATO.
Germany's already been open about their desire not to get involved.
Yeah, it's extremely difficult to tell exactly what's going on here. But nevertheless, you know, I think, again, this is one of those situations where the aggressiveness, and like Stephen Wertheim, you know, pointed out, of George W. Bush in promising NATO membership to Ukraine 15 years ago, some odd, you head down a path, and it's like the mistake was made 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it has, and this is where we're at. So it's, we shall see. But we're getting a lot of takes of like, what was it? Joe Scarborough said something, I think, on Twitter. You know, the withdrawal from Afghanistan is what convinced that Putin he could do this. And this is just, honestly, one of the most, like, moronic takes possible. If you are a country that wants to invade another country and you are wary of the United States striking back, do you do this at a time where they have no military conflicts, or do they have multiple military conflicts that they're waging? I mean, this is just simple, such obvious. To have nothing, you know, if China had some desire in any way to annex Taiwan, they may. One would imagine the time that they would do it would be when the United States is busy with its hands full in other conflicts. Not when there is, they could literally focus on one. I mean, it's just absurd.
And then there's the other takes where it's, everyone's so concerned about Ukraine, right? Which is just, I mean, they see it as a way to exert American might. And what I fear the road that we're going down is involvement that maybe isn't as transparent, say, like the Washington Post reported the other day that the CIA may be considering funding a guerrilla force in Ukraine, and then it becomes a proxy war, which is part and parcel of a Cold War, and then we move further and further down a road that we can't come back from. And that's the real concern here.
I would be shocked if the CIA is not involved already.
Yeah.
To be honest with you,
redouble efforts. Michael McFaul, you know, big establishment, you know,
former ambassador to Russia, I think.
Yeah, tweeted out, imagine if during the Berlin blockade in 1948, Truman had said, better not send any planes. Moscow might think it too provocative. There's one dissimilarity is it was 1949 that Russia got nuclear weapons. So just one difference in comparison is... Maybe we don't want to.
It sort of feels like there's a slight difference right now between Soviet Union's ability for expansiveness. And one could also, point out that, you know, it's not like the Cold War necessarily was the best use of resources over that time. In a moment, we'll be talking to Tony Messenger, Metro columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and author of Profit and Punishment, How America Criminalizes the Poor in the Name of Justice. First, let me remind you, you have now really 2 days left, period. If you hear my voice as I'm speaking, you have 2 days left until 11:59 p.m. tomorrow, Tuesday, January 25th, to get your CBD tinctures. And folks, let me be clear. Let me grab this. Had this right one. SunsetLakeCBD.com. Use the code LEFTISBEST for 20% off generally. But, like I say, until 11:59 p.m. tomorrow night, you can get their new tinctures. They have 750 milligram, 1,500 milligram, 3,000 milligram, 6,000 milligram tinctures are now available in two new flavors, mint and citrus. And also, what is new is they have that 6,000 milligram full spectrum tincture.
Oh, yeah.
They're releasing these new flavored tinctures. If you like the natural tinctures flavor, the one that's a little bit more like hempy tasting, they still got it. Those are still available. I will tell you that the mint has become my go-to at bedtime. And the 6,000 milligram, you get more CBD. People should understand that we say CBD in that way because of, like, sometimes we get in trouble with places that we stream.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, but it is. They also have, like I say, this new product, the 6,000 milligram full spectrum tincture. It's made with purified CBD distillate. The 6,000 milligram tincture is the most powerful product that Sunset Lake CBD has ever produced. A single dropper holds 100 milligrams of CBD. Now, I will tell you this. The one of the things that really makes Sunset Lake different from other places that sell and produce this is that they get third-party certification of exactly what is in all of their products. You can find it on their website. They'll send it to you if you want with your products. Starting, well, doesn't matter when it started, but it ends tomorrow at 12 p.m. Eastern. No, was it 12 p.m. Eastern? 11:59 p.m. Eastern. All CBD tinctures will be 30% off. Now is the time to try these if you've never tried them before. Orders over $100 will receive a free 750 milligram tincture. It's a $30 value for free. You don't need a promo code. All the products will be automatically discounted at checkout. Visit SunsetLakeCBD.com. Try these amazing new products and take advantage of the sale while it lasts. It ends in 24, I don't know, 30, 40 hours?
It ends soon.
Soon. All right, I want to welcome to the program Tony Messenger. He is a Metro columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, author of Profit and Punishment, How America Criminalizes the Poor in the Name of Justice. Tony, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Vigeland. Thanks for joining us.
Sam and Emma, thanks for having me. Good to be here.
So, you tell this story, I guess, that is really, in many respects, a national story, but it takes place in localities, primarily through the stories of three single women. But first, just tell us, like, how did you come across this dynamic? Like, what led you to write the book?
So it started all the way back in 2014 in Ferguson, when I was first introduced to this concept of poor people being abused by the courts. In this case, particularly poor Black people in North St. Louis County, who often got traffic tickets and other minor offenses and were regularly arrested and rearrested and spent time in jail, often because they couldn't afford to keep up with all of these traffic tickets. Many of us, as we were watching the protests unveil themselves on the streets in Ferguson and St. Louis, became sort of introduced to this idea for the first time of cities using their police forces and their municipal courts as fundraising tools. And then a couple of years later, in 2017 and 2018, I came across a couple of cases in rural Missouri involving poor white Missourians, in which they were sent back to jail after they had been convicted of a minor misdemeanor, but because they had gotten a bill for their time in jail. And that is a statute that I didn't realize existed. A lot of lawyers that I talked to didn't realize it existed. And in fact, every state in the nation, except for New Hampshire, has a similar statute that allows cities and counties and in some cases, state prisons to charge people for their time in jail. And what was happening in Missouri and what I since found out is happening in states all over the country is that people are put back in jail when they can't afford to pay for court costs, including sometimes a bill for jail. And these fines and fees that are added to the court system, primarily for poor people charged with minor misdemeanors, create this whole cycle of poverty and debt that is impossible for people to escape. And it is literally the state using the tyranny of big government to put people in debtor's prison. And as I started writing these stories, I would hear from people and get, you know, tips on, oh my gosh, you need to talk to my cousin in Dent County and Caldwell County and St. Francis County. And I found that the poor people in these counties that were the victims of the system, they all knew about it. They just figured, wow, this is the way it works. And in fact, unfortunately, one of the things I point out in my book is that's how the criminal justice system works all across the country. We have cities and counties using their police departments and their municipal courts and their county and district courts as fundraising tools, as backdoor taxes. And the victims are real people charged with minor events who end up having devastating consequences in their lives because they end up spending time in jail long after they've served their time because they owe a bunch of money that is being collected for a bunch of things that have absolutely nothing to do with the crime they were charged with, because our governments want to use the courts as a way to raise money.
I want to get to the specific cases that you outlined too, but is this a function? I mean, like, you know, because usually you think like, oh, well, you know, if you're looking to steal some money, you go to a place where there's the most money. In this instance, you're going to the place where there isn't the most money, but maybe there's the least amount of power to do anything about it. How much of a hole, I guess, is there in the budgets of, and a lot of this has to do with rural areas in particular, relative to what it was years ago? I mean, in other words, like, how much of a need is out there that they stumbled upon this? If it is a function of trying to raise money.
Well, it's interesting. You hit on something that I talk about in the book, and that is that using fines and fees to fund government is horribly inefficient because 80% of the people in the court system happen to be poor. We know that because of statistics where they qualify for the public defender system. And so you're literally talking about governments trying to tax its poorest citizens and not doing a very good job of it in terms of raising money. There was a study in New Mexico that looked at how much it costs to try to raise money this way and found out that governments are spending more money trying to collect fines and fees than they're actually bringing in. And so it's a really bad system. But the reason that it continues is because the legislatures that pass these laws that allow the fines and fees to get out of control, people come to them, various constituencies come to them and say, hey, look, we need money for X, Y, or Z. And those legislatures, many of them, a lot of the states that I write about in the book, Missouri, Oklahoma, South Carolina, prominently, all three states with conservative legislatures that are generally anti-tax. Their state lawmakers have all signed Grover Norquist, I'm never going to raise taxes ever again in the history of my life, no matter what pledge. And so when somebody comes to them, like a group of retired sheriffs who want to increase their retirement fund, rather than go to the general revenue, which is how most government services are funded, lawmakers say, well, we'll just add a $3 fee to all the court cases. And the poor people end up paying for that fee. And that $3 fee gets added to a $10 fee and a $5 fee and a $15 fee. And all of these things add up, and they end up to a cycle of poverty for poor people where they end up being put back in jail. And so what's happening is that the left hand and the right hand, none of them are really talking. The sheriffs go to the legislature and the legislature add this fee. The fee gets added. The Supreme Court says, here's the list of fees you're allowed to collect. The local judge gets that list. And when they get a defendant in front of them, say, well, you're supposed to owe this money. You have to pay this money. And rather than waive it because they're poor or even have an ability to pay hearing to determine whether or not they should be paying those fees, they just accept as part of the regular course of action, we're tough on crime. You came before us. You owe us this money. If you don't pay us this money, we're going to put you back in jail. And that's exactly what they do. And they do it over and over and over again with devastating consequences until lawmakers or civil rights attorneys or Supreme Courts step up and say, wait a minute, this is wrong. This is debtor's prison. We outlawed those in the 1800s. We're not supposed to do this. But it takes a tremendous amount of effort, as I outline in the book, in Missouri and in Oklahoma and South Carolina. I write about a case in Idaho where the Supreme Court said, hey, you know what? We're not going to allow this anymore. It takes a tremendous amount of effort to get folks to really recognize, wait a minute, we're putting people in jail because they're poor. Why are we doing this? What are we going to do to undo this scheme?
So I just, you mentioned debtors' prisons there, and that's really, of course, the first thing that comes to my mind, right? This is a modern day debtors' prison. They're supposed to be illegal. Has there been a 14th Amendment violation here for equal protection? Like, has there been a challenge, a 14th Amendment challenge to these? Because it seems to me that this violates precedent when debtors' prisons were made illegal.
Yeah, so two of the federal lawsuits that I write about, one of them in Oklahoma and one of them in South Carolina, specifically bring 14th Amendment violations to the court. The problem is, if you ask a judge who's putting a poor person in jail because they're poor, if they're sending them to debtor's prison, the judge says, "Oh no. See, this person missed a hearing, so I'm sending them to court because they missed a hearing." And then you ask further, well, what was that hearing for? Well, that hearing was to collect money for fines and fees. Or that hearing was to determine whether or not they had a probation violation because they couldn't afford to pay for their ankle bracelet, or they couldn't afford to pay for their private for-profit probation company that was charging them $30 a month for drug testing. All of these things that lead to people ending up back in jail, sometimes on pretextual reasons, i.e. they missed a court date, they had a warrant out for their arrest, they failed a drug test. All of them have to do with the underlying reason of we're collecting fines and fees from poor people and requiring them to come to court month after month after their cases have been adjudicated. And it's amazing. If you go to any jurisdiction in this country on a day where a judge has what they call their law day, where, you know, people who got all of these summons have to show up. There's a great story out of Alabama just this last week about a town there that has this problem, in which they basically set up their police department as a mini ATM. And the reporter talks about going to court, and there is just this line of people standing outside the courtroom to get in. And all of them are just there because they owe money on minor tickets that the city wants to use to collect to become its tax base.
What about the third parties who are making money off of this? I mean, it's horribly inefficient to raise revenue from the perspective of a state or a municipality. But what about you write about I think it was in the Killian case, and I want to get to hers, but that her court debt was sold to Aberdeen Enterprises. And I imagine there's other sort of like outfits like this that will buy court debt and then they attempt to recover. you know, X number cents on the dollar type of thing. But third parties like that, third parties like private prisons, how much are they profiting from this process? Because I imagine they're also turning around and they're a lobbying force at the state house.
Well, yes. And what happens is the private companies that are part of this sort of prison industrial complex, they partner with groups that are connected to public safety. So, for instance, Aberdeen Enterprises in Oklahoma, which is being sued as part of the federal civil rights lawsuit involving Kendi Killman, one of the main characters in my book, who got arrested on a minor misdemeanor and ended up for years getting all of these notices because she couldn't afford to pay about $1,000 in fines and fees. She lives off of disability. Aberdeen buys the debt. And when they buy the debt from the county, they then add a surcharge. And then they send the collection to the person that owes the debt. And this private company basically threatens them with more jail time if they don't pay the debt. And so the debt that these poor people owe ends up getting higher and higher because of the involvement of these private companies. Well, one of the things that Aberdeen does is it signs a contract with the sheriffs that hire it or the counties that hire it, that they get a kickback. Completely legal. They sign as part of the contract. The same as any of you who have ever emailed with somebody in jail. I email with folks in jail all the time. There's a private company called JPay that takes lots of my money and lots of the money of folks who are unfortunately detainees in local and state and federal prisons. When JPay comes in to offer paid email for inmates, they sign a contract with the local county jail in which the county jail gets a piece of the cut. They get a cut of the contract. And so it creates this unholy alliance between private for-profit companies that make more money if the jails are full. And so one of the reasons that a lot of local jails are full is some of these local companies are private for-profit probation companies. So Brooke Bergen, who's one of the main characters in my book, is this woman in from rural Missouri who stole an $8 tube of mascara. She ended up doing a year in the county jail for stealing an $8 tube of mascara. Now, people listening are going to say, wow, wait a minute, that's ridiculous. Nobody does a year in jail for shoplifting an $8 tube of mascara. But the reason she did is, When she got out of jail after she was originally arrested, she's now being supervised by a for-profit probation company. And that for-profit probation company, she's got to pay them a monthly fee. And then they decide to drug test her. Now, keep in mind, she wasn't charged with a drug offense. But Brooke Bergen, like a lot of poor people in rural Missouri, had an opioid addiction. She had a meth addiction. She was battling drug addiction for much of her adult life. And so the private for-profit probation company is drug testing her. And when she fails a drug test or she misses a phone call to go take that drug test, the private for-profit probation company calls a judge and says, you know what? Put her back in jail. She violated her pretrial release conditions. So they set a court hearing. She goes before the judge. The judge says, well, you failed the drug test. I'm putting you in jail for 10 days. Serve you a lesson. You know what happens when she gets out of jail for 10 days? She gets another bill for more jail time that she can't afford to pay. So this happens to Brooke two or three different times. The judge eventually just says, you know what? Forget it. That year sentence that I suspended because I was being so nice, you're now going to jail for a year. So she does a year in jail for shoplifting an $8 tube of mascara. Now you're thinking, okay, that's harsh, but you know, she failed the drug test, so be it. She gets out of jail and she gets a $15,000 bill for that time in jail. And now her time with the court system is far from over because the judge schedules her to appear once a month to either make a payment on this $15,000 or go back to jail again, debtor's prison. That's literally what was happening in that county until the Missouri Supreme Court eventually stepped in 2019 and said it is illegal in the state of Missouri to put people back in jail because they can't afford to pay the bill that they got for their previous time in jail.
that's just, I mean, it's nuts.
It is. It's nuts. It's crazy. And when you come across something like this, as I did, it just changes your focus. I'm a Metro columnist. I write four columns a week on politics, on crime, on race, on all sorts of things. I can't get away from this topic. The reason I wrote Profit and Punishment is it's so unjust. It is so maddening. It's so obscene. And yet it exists in courtrooms all across the country.
Tell us about, you mentioned Kendi Kilman. She's from Norman, Oklahoma.
Yeah.
And just tell her story. She was 50 years old at the time. Is that it? And
So Kendi lives in Norman. She's got several children. One of her children is disabled, and she has to take care of him. And so really she lives off of federal disability funding to help take care of her son, lives in public housing, has been poor her entire life. Her grandmother gets sick in Arkansas, and she and her common law husband and a couple of their kids are going to drive to go see their sick grandma. And she knows that her car isn't good enough to get her there. So she calls her ex-husband and says, "Hey, I know you've got a car that's good enough to get me there. Can I borrow it?" He says, "No, you can't borrow it, but you can buy my car for $400. Now, if you've been in poverty, you get this story because you're constantly facing this sort of decision. Do I pay for my kids' medicine today? Do I pay my child support today? What do I need to do to get transportation to get to my job? It's constantly a Peter versus Paul, you know, situation. So she pays for this car. They drive to Oklahoma, to Arkansas to see sick grandma. They're there a couple of days. She's getting better. They drive back. In Oklahoma, just north of where they live, they're now already back into Norman where she lives. She's just a few minutes away from home. She gets pulled over. Now, allegedly, she got pulled over because the police officer thought he saw a crack in her windshield somehow while driving next to her. That crack didn't exist. The police officer then tells her, "Well, you know what? I thought I saw a crack. That crack didn't exist. You weren't speeding or anything else, but can I search your car for drugs?" Now, some of us who know the law and are comfortable taking on this challenge would say, "No, you can't search my car for drugs. You don't have any underlying cause. And if you insist, I'm going to call my attorney and the whole problem goes away." But she's a poor person. She's tired. She wants to go home. She's like, "Fine, search my car." So in the trunk of this car that she's owned for less than 48 hours, they find an old pot pipe with some residue in it. Ask her if it's hers. She says no. She has no drug offenses on her in her career. She doesn't take drugs. She doesn't drink alcohol. She has a completely free, clean criminal record. But they find this pot pipe and they arrest her for possession and they take her to jail. And she's handcuffed in the jail in Norman, Oklahoma for several hours before she eventually is able to leave and given the summons to appear in court. She eventually goes to court, stands before the judge, and the first thing she does is she waives her right to a public defender, a major mistake that lots of poor people make, because she walks into court and gets this sheet of paper handed to her by a clerk that says, "Do you have an attorney?" "No." "Do you want a public defender? Are you poor? Do you qualify?" "Yes." "That'll be $40. Now, the form doesn't let her know that the judge can waive that fee, or in most states that the public defender system, if the system exists, will waive that fee. So she just says, "No, I don't have $40. I waived my attorney." Now she's appearing before a judge without an attorney, pleads guilty to these two ridiculous misdemeanor charges that any attorney with, half of a law degree could probably get her out of. And the problem isn't that she's going to go to jail for these things. The problem is it comes with about $1,000 bill, because in Oklahoma, like Missouri, like South Carolina, like North Carolina, Minnesota, California, lots of other states, There are all sorts of fines and fees built into the system that have nothing to do with trying to deter her from having a pot pipe in the trunk of her car. By the way, pot's practically legal in Oklahoma right now. They approved medicinal marijuana, and that's neither here nor there, but it is kind of, you know, we're still penalizing a lot of people for minor drug offenses all over this country while we're going through the process of legalizing that same drug. But she ends up with this $1,000 bill that she owes that she's not going to be able to pay. She doesn't have $1,000. She's not going to be able to have $100 or $200 to pay it down over the next several months. So what happens is the same thing that happens to most poor people. Eventually, she misses a payment. And when she misses a payment, a warrant is issued for her arrest. By the way, most jurisdictions, when they issue a warrant, they add another fee on top of that. They charge you money to issue a warrant. They issue a warrant. And in Kendi's case, Kendi's actually kind of lucky. She's got an older daughter who happens to get on the state's computer system and realizes, hey, there's a warrant out for your arrest. And so she goes to the judge and she stays in the courtroom for half of a day and says, hey, you know, look, I got this warrant out for my arrest. Do you have any money to pay your bill? No. Okay, come back in another month. And this process goes on for years because she can't pay down that debt. And so she is tied to the court system until she can do something about that debt. Eventually, Aberdeen Enterprises, a private company, buys the debt. Her debt gets even higher, and they start to increase the threats until some very smart and caring defense attorneys and nonprofit civil rights organizations get involved and say, you know what? This scheme is really obscene. And it's penalizing poor people and putting many of them back in jail over and over again. And Kendi's story is not unusual. Kendi's story is the story of poor people all across this country who happen to get occasionally a traffic ticket or a minor misdemeanor for various offenses. And they end up in jail and they end up with massive debt and they end up having all sorts of consequences in their lives that folks like me, I'll speak for myself, folks like me, middle-class suburban white guy, generally don't have to deal with, because when I have those situations occur in my life, and they have occurred in my life, I've made mistakes in my life. I've gotten speeding tickets. I got pulled over for not having proper tags on my car. I'm able to write a check and make the whole problem go away.
Right. How much of this, and because you look at three women, one in Salem, Missouri, one in Norman, Oklahoma, like Kennedy, and then the last one, Sasha Darby, in Columbia, South Carolina. How much of this is a small, rural type of phenomena? Like, is it just simply more explicit there, or what?
It's both. It's both. And, you know, I think a lot of the rural jurisdictions, it's worse. Because of just the lack of focus of the legal system on what's actually going on there and the pressure that is.
So in other words, there's no, the ACLU is not going to get wind of this, or there's no attorneys there who are doing, I don't know, defense attorneys who are doing pro bono act, or there's no like local college where there's a law professor or something like that.
Correct. It takes a while for these things to come sort of to the surface. Plus, you have local judges who are elected in many jurisdictions and have the pressure of the local sheriff and the local presiding commissioner who are trying to use the courts to raise money on them being part of this tax collection scheme. It's very much a problem that if you look at it nationally, because it happens in the cities as well. Right now, there is a bill before the New York State Senate, sponsored by State Senator Julia Salazar, called the End Predatory Fines and Fees Act, that tries to get rid of all of these predatory fines and fees in the New York judicial system. Because what happens in a lot of America's big cities where this happens is the primary victims are people of color. Sasha Darby was in Columbia, South Carolina, not a big city, but an urban environment. She's African American. She ended up having to spend more than 20 days in jail because there was a warrant out for her arrest because she got behind on the money that she owed for a minor misdemeanor charge. And she stands before the judge and she doesn't have an attorney. And the judge says, well, you owe me $765 today. Can you pay that? And Sasha says, no, I don't have that money. That's why I missed my payment before. I'm doing the best I can. I've got a job. I've got a kid. I'm trying to take care of things, but I fell behind in those payments. And the judge says, well, you've got a choice. You can either write me a check right now for the $700 that you owe me, or I can send you to jail. And you can go to jail. You talk about a literal debtor's prison. She says, you go to jail and we'll take about $50 off a day from what you owe the court. And once you get that court debt paid off, we'll let you out of jail. That's what happened to Sasha Darby in Columbia, South Carolina. And that happens in a variety of different states, Louisiana, South Carolina. Lots of southern states still have this sort of pay or stay sort of system where they say, well, you know what? They think it sounds humanitarian.
It's insane.
You know, we know you don't have the money. So how about you just stay for our jail, stay in our jail for a while to pay it off? Sasha Darby was pregnant when they put her in the municipal jail to pay off her debt. She lost her baby a couple of days after she gets out of jail.
It's just, it's incredibly cruel, and it's pure insanity. Is it possible for there to be federal legislation that can prevent this? I mean, on some level, it feels like the Constitution already does. It's just that, like, on the ground, it is much harder, you know. So for instance, even in the context of New York State, you pass this law, it feels like there's still local jurisdictions where this could go on ad infinitum unless there is like some type of, I don't know, some type of apparatus that is set up, either a governmental one or an NGO that is going around to jurisdictions to make sure this is not happening. Because if I'm a single mother and I'm having to struggle to make ends meet, I probably am not aware of you said with Kilman, like you should take the lawyer, they'll waive the fee. I mean, there's probably, I'm just caught up trying to do the right thing and have no idea whether I'm, in the process of like uniquely being targeted or not.
So the place to fix the problem is both in the courts and in the legislative arena. And there is a bill in Congress, Jerry Nadler from New York in the House, and Brian Schatz, senator from Hawaii, have sponsored a bill that creates incentive funds for states that do what Senator Salazar is trying to do in New York, getting rid of the fines and fees. So it will create it similar to the way Congress creates incentives for creating highway safety laws. We'll give you more money for your highways if you make them safer. This is a similar sort of idea. If you get rid of your fines and fees, the federal government, hopefully, if this bill goes anywhere, will provide some federal grants to help you replace that funding for a period of time while you figure out what to do. The other way that there is progress being made is through the courts. So in Missouri and Idaho, for instance, there were class action lawsuits brought on behalf of defendants who were being put back in jail because they couldn't afford to pay their fines and fees. And in both Idaho and Missouri, two conservative states, where local circuit judges were putting poor people back in jail to collect fines and fees, the Supreme Courts in both Idaho and Missouri ruled unanimously that you can't do this. This is wrong. This is against the law. It's unconstitutional. It's debtor's prison. And so there's progress being made there in the courts. But again, that's slow. That's a year or two long case in one state and a second state. There are federal lawsuits in South Carolina and Oklahoma about these schemes. There are other lawsuits being filed by these similar organizations in a variety of places. But what you really have to do is you have to upend the entire fines and fees schemes. We have to decide as a country that we're not going to use the courts and use the police as a fundraising tool, because the result is poor people end up spending a lot of time in jail, and it has a negative impact on their communities. It has a negative impact on economies. It doesn't do anything to improve public safety. This is a problem that is so massive, it's going to take state by state legislation. I'm really hopeful that the New York bill passes. In this country, we tend to have, you know, sort of a situation where folks in Missouri pay attention to what happens in New York and California, and hopefully eventually, you know, they make their way to flyover land. But, you know, here it's sort of happening the opposite way too. You have Missouri and Idaho Supreme Courts recognizing that this is a problem, and hopefully more and more people starting to realize we should not be using our courts and our judges and our police and our prosecutors all as part of this process to just collect money from poor people. And to fix it, we got to have judges do the right thing. They need to have ability to pay hearings. They need to waive fees. They need to make sure that nobody's waiving the right to an attorney. Then we have to have legislatures stop adding new fines and fees on top of the ones that already exist. Or go the next step further and get rid of the underlying fines and fees. There is a long process that is going to take to unravel this scheme. And in the meantime, unfortunately, a whole lot of folks are going to face, debtor's prison until we can do something to fix it.
Last question. So, I mean, it's clear. I mean, this may not even be relevant relative to what the solution is. I mean, you've walked through, you know, exactly what needs to happen to end these practices. But from your reporting, is it your sense that this is about a way of generating revenue, or is there like some type of, you know, the story of you owe whatever it was, $750, and I'll put you in jail $50 a day. You'll work it off, I guess. That to me just sounds like a weird, moral punishment for being poor. Like, is this apparatus more about punishing and policing poor people than it is ultimately about making money for the town or whatever it is?
I don't know the answer to that. In the book, I asked Jill Webb. Jill Webb is one of the attorneys, former public defender, who ended up filing the lawsuit on behalf of Kenny Kilman. And she discovered this scheme similar to me. She just was representing these folks in the public defender's office and kept finding out they had these cases where they were just in jail because they owed money. And she went to the jail one day and just started interviewing people and found out that almost everybody there was there because they owed money. And she became committed to trying to undo this scheme. And I asked her one day, I said, Jill, I said, do they know what they're doing here? Or is this just one of these things that sort of like the boiling of the frog that takes place over a long period of time and it becomes ingrained in the system? And she said, Tony, I think a lot of the folks involved in these schemes just hate poor people. And I don't know that that's the case all over the country. I don't know that every one of the judges that I wrote about that put somebody in debtor's prison, every one of the lawmakers who passed one of these laws, I don't know that they all hate poor people, but I cover a lot of legislative movement in the country and in Missouri in particular. And there's a lot of legislation that looks at poor people like second-class citizens. And so I think that's part of the problem. I think we have a cultural problem where we don't believe that everybody's civil rights are worth the same that my civil rights are worth. Somehow mine are worth more because I make more money than the person who lives a few blocks away. And so that's a complicated problem that gets beyond the Constitution and state law and appropriate actions by judges. It gets to the underlying issues that we have in our country. Do we love and care for our fellow man and believe that that they have the same rights that all of us have? That's the question I ask at the end of the book that I hope readers ultimately ask themselves is, do the civil rights of people like Kendi Kilman and Brooke Bergen and Sasha Darby, are they worth less than your rights because they happen to be poor? And I know how I answer that question. I don't know how ultimately our state lawmakers and public officials who are going to have to fix this problem answer the question. Jill Webb seems to think that a lot of them just really don't believe that poor people should have the same rights as the rest of us. And I hope we can get beyond that as a country if that's the case.
Tony Messenger, Metro columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, author of Profit and Punishment, How America Criminalizes the Poor in the Name of Justice. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Really illuminating and disturbing. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, folks.
Jeez.
I mean, there's an ideology in this country that, and it's arguably capitalism, that you are morally, it's a moral failure to be poor here. And in this country. I mean, and it has been one that has been, you know, we talked about this a lot with the Republican Party. I mean, you know, like the Paul Ryans with their story about the brown bag.
And Trump.
Kids. Trump is a product, a total product.
He's
of
an
that.
Avatar for that.
Absolutely.
Well, and happier news, Sarah Palin has COVID.
Wasn't she bragging about not getting the vaccine the other day?
Just a reporter, because she's suing the New York Times for defamation. The judge has to, the judge learned last night that Sarah Palin tested positive for COVID. She is, of course, unvaccinated, the judge notes. So the that spicy litigation is going to have to wait 10 or so days.
Yeah, we'll
as
see.
As long as he's okay.
Right. Well. Folks, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show and you get the fun half. Also, Majority Live, check it out. We got our Boston show. It's May 15th at 2 p.m. The whole crew there. And we may actually have a musical guest. Yeah.
Is it the Dropkick Murphys?
No.
I like that stuff, yeah.
Oh, my God. No.
Oh, those
maybe
are
that'll
the guys.
Be my entrance music.
Good.
That's the guy like from the opening sequence of The Departed, right?
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
I don't think so, dude. No. Quality. We're doing a little better than that. Also, don't forget the AM Quickie. Go to amquickie.com. You can sign up for our newsletter. People love
it. It's great. I think it's really well done.
Great way to keep up on the news very quickly. You read it quick. And also we have merch. So check it all out. It's your support that makes this show possible, ladies and gentlemen. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian Media universe?
Yeah, yesterday for Left Reckoning patrons at patreon.com/Left Reckoning, David Griscom and I released, we're starting from Marx's early writings. Now we're going to do our Marx reading series, and we did a criticism of Hegel's philosophy of right. If that sounds complicated, just know that's the one with the religion is the opiate of the masses quote. So we dig into Marx and how he was criticizing a bunch of folks early in his writing career for focusing too much on idealism of particularly religion, and that you'd actually need to think about the material underpinnings of reality. So check that out, patreon.com/leftreckoning. We got Marshall Steinbaum talking about student loans on Wednesday.
There you go. All right, 646-257-3920 is the number. We will take your calls. See you in the fun half.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.